one of your biggest fans is here in the station, and that young woman.
Yeah, we were talking on
that's our writer. I guess you can't go any place these days without finding someone who likes your stuff, huh?
It's amazing how many there are.
I want to talk about your work, about your science fiction, about your life a little bit, and also, of course, about The Lady, which is your new book. First, we ought to talk about Pern, that long-lost Earth colony. There have been 5 Pern books, is that right?
No, I beg your pardon, there are now 9.
9?
9. And 3 ancillary texts.
What does that mean?
Well, some of the fans said, "But Anne, you never mentioned that there were craft halls where people could paint and learn how to do arts and crafts and make their rockside weirs more attractive." And I said, "Well, they're there. You don't have to keep saying there's a sky for people to believe there's one above you. I mean, there's certain things that are so common that you don't mention them. So they're there." And they said, "Well, yes, but where there? And what do they do? And what's their formation?" I said, "Oh, Lord. Well, I can't write a book to put all that in. And if you put too many details, you slow up the plot." So we decided with Jody Lynn Nye, who's a young friend of mine, that we would write a guidebook to Pern, which would put in the flora, the fauna, the cats, the dogs, the rocks, everything else, where the craft halls were, everything they could possibly want to know of the detail that I can't get in the books. So that's coming out, too.
Well, tell the listeners a little bit about Pern and what makes this world unusual.
Pern is a planet around a star called Rookbach in the Sagittarian sector of space. We have not yet been there. Whether we go there or not, I do not know. But at one point, I thought it would be a good idea to visit the planet and keep people away from what was happening on Earth. The interesting thing about science fiction is that we are talking about futures at a time when people are very worried that we will have one. So any kind of a future in which they can feel at ease is useful. On Pern, I decided not to have wars. I'm sick to my eye teeth of wars. So I would have a menace that was threatening people. That was the conflict element. And this is a mycorrhizoid spore that drops from the heavens and hits the ground or anything organic, and it eats it. Now, no one wants to be eaten alive, and no one wants to see their planet denuded, so they bioengineered a life form from a local indigenous life form, and it looked like a dragon when it got big enough, so they called it dragons. Now, a dragon is the amalgam of all you ever wanted in your childhood pet. It's bigger and better, and it loves you. It will die for you, and it will die if you do.
Probably even breathe fire for
it
you.
It breathes fire, and it teleports, and wouldn't you like a 40-foot fire-breathing teleporting dragon as your best friend? I think that's what gets most people.
In my neighborhood, yeah.
Down
the street.
They're called Cadillacs here. This was the basis, and then we went on and had problems on the planet. And once you solve one set of problems, you're going to get another. And the characters were engaging, so I kept writing about them. And the next thing I knew, I had 2 sets of books, 2 sets of trilogies, and then another book to explain something that happened in the past, and then another book to explain something that happened again in the past. And now I've gone back and I've written the actual landing party and what happened when they first got onto this pastoral planet Pern. And it's coming out in November, and it's called Dragon's Dawn. And the guidebook is coming out with that, and a portrait gallery of all the people, because you don't have many illustrations in science fiction. And half the ones you do have on the cover don't bear any relation to things within the book. So this time I get to say what goes on the cover, goes inside as the illustrations. And
that's power. Publishers usually
that honey is clout.
It is really. Publishers. I was looking at a book contract the other day, and it looks to me once the publisher sent you the money, you lost all your rights. The binding is not yours. The type is not yours. The dust jacket isn't yours. I mean, they run it all.
Well, actually, The Lady, which is my latest book from Ballantine. It's a contemporary book set in Ireland in 1970 and deals with horse people, because I'm a horse person myself. And I think is one of the nicest styled books. It's a pleasure to read it. It looks elegant inside.
It does. And it's a pretty dust jacket, too. Well, let's hold the lady for a second, because I kind of want to move up in a chronological sense and go back to your science fiction a little bit. Your work is actually an amalgam of science fiction and fantasy, isn't it?
No, not fantasy. I ask you to believe one impossible thing, that people got the Pern in one piece. And after that, it's fairly logical. Pern is an Earth-type planet, and there's plenty of scientific proof that there are such planets circulating around suns.
But dragons?
Well, that's the second impossible thing I ask you to believe. But I do it so carefully that you have no trouble believing it or loving dragons.
Dragons are very important in your life, aren't they?
No, horses are.
Well, now, wait a minute. I was reading a lot of the publicity material, and I have seen that you have clones that have dragon imprints. People have sent you all sorts of...
Oh, dragons, yes, they collect me. I now have 372.
So dragons,
dragons
are important.
Yeah.
You have 372 dragons?
Yes, I've been sent that many. Someone says, do I collect them? And I say, no, they collect me. They are sent by fans. And they come in all materials, from pipe cleaners to glass to copper. I have a magnificent copper dragon. It stands about this big.
That's pretty small.
Well, you don't really want anything that much bigger in a small house. And I have a lot of artwork, which I've been given. I am pleased because it has generated so much in the art fields. You have art. You have jewelry, you have costuming, you have the little models themselves. It's been very stimulating to the entire field.
Well, didn't I read someplace in here that some of your fans even come dressed up as dragons when there are science fiction conventions?
Dragons are a little difficult to dress up as, but we have had one or two in costume parades. But people now dress up in Pern costumes, and they assume a Pern persona. And they join Weirs, which is one of my social groups in on Pern. I nearly said on Ireland. And they have fun for a weekend, get away from their cares. And it's a disciplined group.
What got you interested in science fiction, which seems like such a male-dominated field?
It was when I first got into it. It isn't anymore. In the 50s, I was reading science fiction, the good old Ace Double novels with Andre Norton and Edmund Hamilton.
Oh, I had a lot of those, the A.E. Van Potts.
Oh, boy, yeah, they were great. And they didn't write them fast enough, so I sat down and started writing one of my own. And eventually I got the hang of it, and my first story was published in 54, so I've been at this business a while now.
Who published that first story?
Sam Moskowitz, in a magazine that 2 issues later folded.
Couldn't have been IF, could it?
No, it wasn't IF. It was Science Fiction Plus.
You don't remember that one.
It wasn't around very long.
Yeah, I used to, in my teenage years, I used to read science fiction. It was consummate, and I collected all of the magazines. As a matter of fact, I still have all of that stuff.
Well, they're worth a fortune. Hang on to them.
I have a full run of Galaxy and a full run of Fantasy
Analog
and Science Fiction.
Astounding.
Astounding going back to 46 or 47. But then around the late or mid or late 50s, I began to stop buying it. I was in college, and I went on to other things. But, of course, I have a very, very great feeling for science fiction. I just did a five-part profile of Isaac Asimov, and next week a profile of Piers Anthony. You probably run into both at various...
I know, Isaac. He's always trying to pitch When Irish Eyes Are Smiling, too high for me to sing. But he's only a lousy tenor, and I'm a dramatic soprano.
Probably trying to steal your stuff, too.
No. And Piers Anthony is fantastic.
Very outspoken. I mean,
yes, he's always had his opinions.
Oh, really?
Did he get punning for you?
But he got on to Kurt Vonnegut.
Yes.
I'm sure he's expressed his feelings about that.
Yes, he has.
You've made a departure in going into mainstream fiction with the lady. Tell me about this book and why you decided to break with your tradition.
Oh, I've written 6 other books in this sort of romantic tradition.
Oh?
Yeah. I started that in the 70s when the old Gothic romance was popular. And I had three then, and then I've since added to it when I had a story I wanted to tell. But I've been living in Ireland for the last 17 years, and I'm heavily involved in a horse business.
What took you to Ireland, by the way?
Well, the flip answer is it was 3,000 miles away from my ex-husband. The reality was they had a very good school system, and I had two younger children to be educated. And my mother felt that she could be happy in Ireland. And indeed, she did feel happy and safe until her death in 1974. So it worked out well for me.
Don't they also offer tax breaks there that most
countries don't? Yes, I still pay taxes, but I get a tax break by living in Ireland.
Especially for writers.
Yes.
Now, how does that work exactly?
If you can prove that you earn your income from writing, you do not have to pay Irish taxes. Once you start making interest on the money, then you have to pay Irish tax on the interest. Or if you start another business, as I do, you are required to pay Irish tax on that. But your earnings from your writing are tax exempt.
Well, that was a digression, but go ahead. 17 years ago, you went to Ireland, but you became very interested in horses.
I always had been, but this gave me a chance to learn more about horses in the proper environment, because I think the Irish horse is the most versatile animal in the world. I now breed, and we have three-day eventers. I have a small farm.
What's a three-day eventer?
It's what Princess Anne does on horses. There are three disciplines throughout 3 days. The first one is dressage, which is mannered paces to his set test. The next day is cross-country, fields and tracks, and steeplechase. And if the horse is still able to walk the third day, he's allowed to show jump. It's very exhausting for both horse and rider, but it's the ultimate.
Is this done on your farm?
Not on my farm, no, but in areas around Punchestown, Badminton, Burley, in England. And, of course, there is a three-day event in the Olympics.
Well, tell me about the lady where the focus is definitely on horses.
Well, it's curious. Kids get started on horses about 7 or 8 or 9. And a lot of them stay with horses. And it is a dedication. It's a total dedication. Horses have to be taken care of 7 days a week, all day long, you know. It's not something you can just shove away into a corner. And it takes a certain kind of person to want to give up so much of an outside life to horses. Particularly the kids, they get so involved. And the lady is about that sort of an involvement in Ireland in 1970, when a lot of things were going on, like bank strikes. You've never had a bank strike here. Crazy things.
No, bank failures, but not bank strikes. No.
And there was, the troubles in the north were escalating. So there was a lot going on in 1970. And I placed it in a small family group and how it was affecting them, and how they were affecting their own community.
Do you find it risk-taking at all to depart, although you said you had written some other books in the romantic vein, but do you find it a risk departing from the books in which you're known to do something which is not quite the same?
No, because with modesty, I say that people see Anne McCaffrey's name on a book and they know they're going to get a good read. I've had guys read it. I've had guys read the romances and said, you know, I don't usually read this stuff, but you don't write too badly. So it's cross-category. I get them coming or going. And I've had women say, oh, I read Stitch and Snow, and I just loved it. And then I saw another book on with your name on it, and I took it, and it was Dragonflight. And at first I wasn't too sure I liked it. She said, but you're such a good writer, I read it anyway. And then they get hooked.
So you think there is a lot of crossover there?
Oh, I know there is in my field.
What's it like living in Ireland?
That's great. We have green on the ground all year long instead of that brown you've got. Very pleasant. I live between the hills of Wicklow and the sea at Greystones, and it's beautiful.
Is there a writer's colony, or do writers get together? I know that a lot of writers in Ireland.
Writers who are writing are writing. The myth that we're all carousing in the local pub and telling jokes and whatnot is not true. You're usually sitting at your word processor working. And every now and then, for instance, coming to New York, I take a break and get out and see people and talk and stop worrying about that monitor in front of me and the little green letters popping up and down.
Because Richard Condon lived in Ireland for a long time, and he was telling me that he had to leave. He moved to Dallas. He said it was so quiet, and only once a week the Guinness man would come around, but that's about the only person he saw. He finally had to leave.
Well, he lived back of beyond. I live just outside of Dublin. I've got the country around me, but I've got very good restaurants in the area, and I do have a couple of writer friends, Catherine Kurtz and her husband Scott McMillan, Diane Duane and Peter Morwood, and Jim Hogan live in the area. And we do get together for dinner and sort of wrap, but it's not an everyday occurrence.
The atmosphere in the Irish Republic, I would assume, is vastly different from the North.
Yes, it is. It's very laid back. There's a joke going around saying, is there a word in the Irish language for tomorrow? And somebody replied, not that connotes such urgency.
How do the Irish treat outsiders? Because you obviously have an Irish, you are of Irish extraction, with an Irish-type name, but how is it for an American or some other outsider to come in and settle?
So long as you have good manners and don't make any ways, no one's going to give you any trouble. I'm known more as being the Yank with the skewbald horse than I am as the science fiction writer, which I think is quite an accolade.
Are you going to be making a tour?
No, not now. I am touring myself back home to Ireland as fast as I can tomorrow.
So, but you did come to do some promotion on the book.
I was at a convention in Louisville.
Louisville?
Louisville. Learned how to pronounce it very quickly.
What sort of convention was that?
It was a Draconis convention, since this is the year of the dragon. And we had a marvelous time, except for the Clays County Tiger basketball team, which was there for the Sweet 16 finals. And they were the rowdiest, nastiest group. Some of our people in costume had been hassled by them. And evidently the police had been told to leave the so-and-sos alone to enjoy themselves. But I thought Kentucky people were raised to be polite and courteous, certainly to older men and women. And I didn't see any of that in the Clay County Tiger group.
No, they were just punks.
Yeah, they were, and it was a shame because we were having a marvelous convention until you got in the elevator and had to be hassled by these yabos.
No, they were probably on probably taking a lot of beer.
Generally, it's the other conventions join us because we're having more fun.
Well, you look like a lady who has a lot of fun, Anne McCaffrey, and I'm anxious to get this report on the radio because I know there are a lot of people who just love your work and they want to know more about it and more about you. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much, Don.